Welcome to the Whiskey Rebellion. This is David Silkenet in Edinburgh, and I'm joined as always by Frank Cogliano. How are you doing, Frank?
I'm great, David. Thank you very much. I, too, am in Edinburgh, but for about, I don't know, the eighth week running, we are not together.
Yes, we are like about a quarter of a mile apart geographically, but you know, a million miles apart in this weird social geography we have today. Right. Obviously, there's been tons of things in the news in the past week, but one story that is sort of recurring and one problem that will be looming for the weeks and months to come is the effect of the coronavirus on the economy, in particular its effect on unemployment. Over the past 6 weeks, more than 30 million Americans have applied for unemployment benefits, and it's been on the order of 1/2 of American households say that they have been impacted on some level by the coronavirus in terms of their finances, either losing jobs or reducing their hours, reducing the number of clients they have and whatnot. So what we want to do is sort of try to provide some context to this enormous spike in unemployment. We had gone from one of the lowest levels of unemployment in American history to one of the highest levels of unemployment almost overnight. And so we want to see if we can provide some context for making sense of how we got to where we are, and maybe provide some context for how we'll get out of this, and when we'll get out of this.
Yeah, but it's fitting we're having this conversation, I suppose. Well, it's May 2nd today, but it's the May Day weekend, which of course internationally, but not in the United States, is Labor Day.
Yes, exactly. Right. So unemployment, Frank. If we were to talk about unemployment, say in your period, in the colonial era or the early republic, what does unemployment look like?
Well, in the first instance, it doesn't look like anything, because in order to discuss unemployment in a meaningful way, as we'll see in the next few minutes, you need to be able to measure it. You need to be able to measure the unemployment rate. And you began by saying or noting that the number of people applying for unemployment relief or unemployment insurance has exceeded 30 million in the past few weeks, I think past 6 weeks. And we have no comparable statistics for the colonial period. We don't really have them for the 19th century. As you and I were talking about before we went on the air, it's very difficult to measure unemployment in a society where 1/5 of the people are enslaved, which was the case in late 18th century America and into the 19th century, as you well know. So on one hand, this is a case where you and I are out of our depths as far as our particular periods of research expertise. On the other hand, there was unemployment, or there were unemployed people or underemployed people, or there have been throughout American history, including in the colonial period. I mean, unemployment or employment is closely tied, of course, to the health and robustness of the economy. And in the 1780s, for example, immediately after the conclusion of the War of Independence, the United States experienced a really severe economic downturn, one which, along with, I don't know, the depressions of 1819 and 1873 and 1892, et cetera, is one of the worst the United States experienced before the Great Depression of the 1930s. And so there's a severe economic downturn right after independence that threw people out of work. There was also a little bit of an economic downturn in the 1760s, and again we saw people only 5% of Americans in the 1760s lived in cities, and those cities were small, but there was, as measured in contemporary records, there was a kind of spike in unemployment, at least in cities. It's very difficult to measure in rural areas and in an agricultural economy, in fact.
So I guess the point you're making is, before the market revolution, you know, most people are not in cities, and most people are working in agriculture, in which there's always employment, there's always work to be done, people aren't considering it employment in the same ways. You don't have an employer.
That's right. And yes, that's right. And consequently, as you say, there's always work to be done, even if that work is not necessarily profitable in the way we might measure it in a market economy. But there was a degree of welfare, however, as we use the term, in colonial America, especially in colonial New England. And so there was a kind of form of relief in certain in towns, but it was based on, and this resonates with contemporary practice, it was based on where you were from. So you'd have to go to your hometown to get relief. And they had a system, a kind of negative system called warning out, where basically if you were unemployed in a town in Massachusetts in the 1770s or 1760s, you could be warned out, which was basically the selectmen, the people who governed the town, would tell you to get out of town and go home. Or that was, even if they didn't really mean that you should leave, what they were saying was you're not eligible for any relief benefits because you're not from here.
So what would relief benefits look? I mean, is this like a poorhouse? What is the relief benefits you get?
I mean, it's a little bit of payment so you can eat. And wealthier towns, and it's often church based, of course. Or there's a fusion of church and state in colonial New England before the Revolution, and so it's closely tied to that. It's a little bit of money, or it could be food. But yes. But the fact is that interests me. I think particularly. As we think about unemployment in later times and benefits in later times, it's very closely tied with where you're allegedly from. So you can get warned out, which is basically them telling you, you need to hit the road.
Okay.
So you get a little bit of that. But the unemployment...
There's an interesting tension there between, or at least I think a dynamic that's going to play out in other places about you know, who's responsible for helping the poor and the unemployed, whether that's the state or whether that's sort of charitable organizations or religious organizations and where
right.
where that dynamic lays.
That's right. Now I'll hand things over to you in a second. I think for most of your century in the 19th century, it's the latter. It's supposed to be charity and so on. And we don't see the rise of the state as a key actor in this realm until really the progressive era and beyond. And now in the modern world with a market economy, you know, the state is really the main actor when it comes to unemployment benefits and unemployment insurance. So you're right. That's a key element of the discussion. What happens in your sanctuary?
You know, with the market revolution, so with sort of the growth of manufacturing, with the growth of transportation networks in the first half of the 19th century, you do find a greater sense of people being employed, right? And so people working for somebody else for wages. And there's some really great scholarship that's been done on this by Seth Rockman and Scott Sandage and some others that point out really how hard it is for people who are working in cities. When you have economic downturns, you do have what we would consider sort of widespread unemployment. And even in good times, employment tends to be very short-term, very seasonal. People would often be, trying to cobble together multiple different kinds of employment over the course of the year, working for, if they were in Rockman's book in Baltimore, they'd be working in the docks for a few months, but then they'd be working in a factory for a few months, and then be out of work for a few months. And so there's a sense in which there's a growing class of people who are dependent upon wages and therefore struggle when those wages disappear. But I think it's really in the late 19th century when you get sort of the idea of unemployment. And in fact, when the term unemployed becomes something that's applied to the kinds of people we think of as being unemployed. If you talk about the unemployed in the early 19th century, people are actually usually talking about those classes of people who never work. Which could mean like small children or the elderly or the disabled. They would be the unemployed. The modern usage of somebody who wants to work but isn't, it really develops in the 1870s.
Yes, that's right. I mean, the modern definition of unemployed as it relates to receiving unemployment benefits is the opposite of that. So that those figures exclude children, the elderly and those unable to work. So unemployed is usually defined by the government as you're able to work, you are willing to work, you're seeking work and unable to find it.
Yeah, and we can talk maybe later about sort of the problems with that definition. Yeah. When you come up with a number, that obscures lots of things. And one of the people who's really responsible for actually trying to come up with these numbers and sort of quantify it is a man by the name of Carol Wright, who is starts in the Massachusetts, so basically establishes the Massachusetts Bureau of Labor Statistics, and then goes to D.C. and establishes the National Bureau of Labor Statistics, where he's trying to sort of quantify, you know, how much unemployment there is, because on some position that you can't deal with the problem unless you know how big the problem is. And he's doing this in the midst of, you know, one of the what were called in the 19th century panics, where you are having massive economic downturns with large amounts of unemployment. Then, you know, a panic that starts in 1873 and lasts until 1877. And it's a panic in which there's not only lots of unemployment, but lots of people who are still employed have their wages reduced significantly. So you have lots of labor unrest, the big 1877 railroad strike, which is a consequence of these, you know, wage cuts, something that we're, I guess, also seeing at the moment. And, you know, one of the things you have happening in the late 19th century is you really are having people, the urban population is growing tremendously. The amount of people who are working for other people is becoming, if not the majority of the population, at least a large segment of the population. And it's really only, I think, in this period, in the post-Civil War period, that you can talk about employment and unemployment in our modern terms, because it's only then when you have the abolition of slavery and which people are, you know, that work is considered in a sort of a modern, semi-modern form, sort of to be the default, and in which you have sort of a free labor ideology that valorizes work and employment along these lines, that it really only makes sense to talk about unemployment in these terms then. And lots of people, even under the best of times in the late 19th century, do experience a lot of unemployment. You know, one of the things about this sort of growing industrial economy is that you are having lots of workers who are employed a lot of the time. You know, there's some work by Alex Kazar where he talks about, you know, between 1870 and 1930, sort of at the boom of this industrial economy, one out of every five workers is unemployed for a significant amount of the year, for a couple of months at least every year. So they'll be working for a few months or a few days or a few weeks and then lose a job or have a job disappear because it's the factory closes down seasonally or what have you. And so unemployment was a fairly sort of regular part of the economy and the workforce and the sort of laboring experience, even when the economy is good.
So David, are we using the same word to describe two different things in the sense that so what Kazar is talking about in the late 19th century is more seasonal work as opposed to when we say unemployment today and measure the unemployment rate, which is, you know, the kind of fixation. The way we use the term now is much more specific, or am I misunderstanding you?
No, I mean, I think part of it's stuff that is seasonal, and obviously when economists do the unemployment rate today, they adjust it seasonally based on, you know, varying demands that are predicated upon the weather and other things. But I think he's actually talking about, you know, factories shutting down and businesses closing down unexpectedly, and some factories that will be open one day and close the next. You know, I think that the precarity of labor was really quite high for much of the late 19th and early 20th century.
Well, it was, sorry to interrupt, but yeah. Even now, I mean, there have been periods, I think, right at the end of the First World War and in 1944, American unemployment was as low as 1% or between 1% and 2%. But economists even today estimate that, you know, it can really only go as low as about 4-4.5% because of people changing, just the churn in the economy of people losing, changing jobs, places closing, things like that. So to some extent, maybe we are still with that kind of, there are elements of that 19th century practice still up in the economy today.
Well, I mean, but I guess the difference is that, you know, when people talk about full employment in a modern context where they put it at roughly 5%, give or take a point or two, what part of what they're concerned about is if you go below that, then you create the opportunities for inflation. And so, you know, anytime you get to sort of the 1% level, then people have to be poaching other people for jobs and what have you. And so it's not sort of sustainable. But I think in the 19th century, in the late 19th and early part of the 20th century, there is sort of structurally a much sort of higher level of unemployment, and sort of that being a regular part of most working people, or at least a lot of working people's experience, that they would spend maybe a month or two every year unemployed, even when they were fully employed the rest of the time. You know, and thinking about sort of the role of government in this, one of the things you do find in the end of the 19th century is people starting to call for both local, state, and federal governments to respond to unemployment, you know, which I think sort of recognizes that unemployment isn't something that happens to an individual. It happens to groups of people, and it happens, you know, a recognition that the economy has an effect, you know, on a broader scale, and the government can have a response to that. And probably the best example of this is Coxey's Army from 1894, which was basically an unemployed army led by a man named Jacob Coxey, who marched from Massillon, Ohio, which is where he lived, to Washington, D.C. And this is the first actual march on Washington. We think of this phenomenon of marching on Washington as being something that happens a lot in the 20th century, but the first time that people do it is in 1894, and what they're demanding is that the government create jobs for unemployed people. And this is in the midst of one of these sort of huge panics, the Panic of 1893, which, you know, would have been the Great Depression if it wasn't for the Great Depression.
Would you say, David, I mean, we've seen over the past couple of weeks, partially encouraged by President Trump, these protests, and again, if you could see me, you could see I'm using air quotes, these protests. We saw one just a couple of days ago at the Michigan State House. We have seen protesters turning up, sometimes armed, to demand the reopening of the economy in various states and the lifting of COVID-19 restrictions. Is it fair to say they're akin to Coxey's Army?
I don't think they're remotely like Coxey's Army, because Coxey's Army, despite the name, had no guns.
Right.
They had bicycles. They rode bicycles. There's great pictures. I mean, there was a bicycle craze in the 1890s, and a lot of them rode bicycles, which I think is great. I mean, I think one of the things about the recent protests, and it's hard to sort of tell exactly if protest is the right word, who's behind these things and who's orchestrating them. That seems to be there seems to be some astroturfing going on there, but it tends not to be people who are at the bottom of the social order who are desperate to go back to work so they can put food on the table. You know, it tends not to be the hairdressers or the auto mechanics or the what have you. It tends to be the people who say, "I want to go and get my hair cut at the barber shop," or "I want to go get my car serviced." People who are, you know, actually middle class people who are demanding things being reopened. So it seems like a very different kind of protest than what Coxey was representing. What's your read on it?
Well, as you say, it is difficult to read, and I think there are two things at work here. I think there is genuine distress across the United States and across the world, in fact, but our brief today is the United States, about rising unemployment. I mean, 30 million people signing on, attempting to get unemployment benefits in 6 weeks is a huge number, and it's undoubtedly higher than that because people haven't been able to get on, and there are all kinds of reasons we may or may not get to this afternoon. So that's an astounding figure, and we've gone from, as you say, near full employment just about, you know, maybe 2 months ago to, you know, the latest figure that I can see, official figure from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, is as of April 18th, 12.4% unemployment in the United States. It's higher than that, we know, but at the height of the Great Recession, you know, back in 2008-09, unemployment was about 10%. So things are bad, and I think there's genuine economic distress, especially in areas that have not yet been that adversely affected by the pandemic, where people are thinking, okay, we're seeing the economic consequences of this, but we don't see the public health issue. And I think that I think there is genuine distress and genuine anger about some of the restrictions. But I also think, as you suggested a moment ago, some of this is being roiled, is being encouraged either by the people who donate to far-right causes in the United States or media organizations that profit from far-right unrest in the U.S. We've seen, you know, there are echoes of the Tea Party of a decade ago as well in this. And it's very – and some of it is – alt-right cosplay, you might say, all these people with their guns and their tactical gear and everything else.
These are expensive guns people are carrying, so these are not done by people who are making minimum wage.
That's right. So I guess what I'm saying is I agree with you that there's that element to it, but I do think there's genuine distress as well. And this is a question that we're seeing debated across the world, and we're seeing a similar debate here in the UK about – what reopening looks like, how you reopen, and there's a delicate balance to be struck between the public health questions and the questions of economic health. And that's a very difficult balance to strike. And to some extent, this is a manifestation. It's a sort of very crude manifestation of one side of that debate.
I think that sort of brings us to unemployment insurance, because I think that's a key element to this whole thing. Because, you know, the American system of unemployment insurance starts during the Great Depression. Wisconsin, I think, is the establishes at the state level in 1932.
Yeah, 32.
In 1935, it becomes part of a federal program as part of the Social Security Act. But it's always been this very interesting sort of federal program partnership between the national government and state governments in terms of how the money gets distributed. So the way the system works in Massachusetts is different than how it works in California, is different than how it works in Nevada, and including how much money people get from unemployment.
Yes, the benefits are more generous in some states than others.
And I guess the rationale for this has to do with sort of the cost of living and what have you. But it's a sort of decentralized system. And obviously it's a system that's not designed for this particular kind of scenario where you go from full employment to widespread unemployment. You know, lots of the system seems to be breaking. Some of them seem to be using antiquated software from the 1960s and aren't really equipped to deal with millions and millions of people applying for unemployment. And I think there have been some arguments made, and they seem reasonable, that some governors are urging their states to reopen in part because they don't want to expand their unemployment system, or can't expand their unemployment system for a variety of both political and structural reasons. Besides unemployment insurance, what other sort of responses can government have, or has government had to widespread unemployment?
Well, in the current situation, of course, there's also been the $1,200 payout to people and again, there have been problems with that system as well. But that's in addition to unemployment. So we've seen that. But unemployment insurance, as it's evolved since the 1930s in the United States, has always been, I think, in most places, you're only eligible for 26 weeks. You have to be looking for work. There are kind of particular requirements of that system. You're right that it's a very interesting federal state collaboration, and that means depending on how much money states put into it, the benefits are greater in some states than others. But it's been fairly it's regimented, and it assumes, if you will, an unemployment rate, maybe between 5 and 10% at most. It's not necessarily set up for the kind of mass unemployment and rapid unemployment that we've seen in recent weeks, which we haven't really seen since the Depression.
I think that's right.
I think on one hand, some state governors are quite cynically seeking to reopen, and again, I'm using that term advisedly, because it will lessen their unemployment, their commitment, and their requirement to extend unemployment benefits to citizens within those states. But on the other hand, there also the system has been overwhelmed simply by the scale and scope of this.
Yeah.
And I think that so I think people could people of goodwill could still not know how to deal with this.
Oh, I think that's right. I mean, New York State, which has been locked down as hard as any place, in part because it's the epicenter of this whole thing, has been trying very hard to manage its unemployment system, which clearly, as you point out, not designed for this.
And let's not forget the people who are responsible for doing that implementation are working from home themselves. We're all working from home. It's hard.
And, one of the sort of assumptions of the unemployment system is that if you are unemployed, then you should be actively looking for work. Right. And some of the laws undergirding these things have that as the sort of requirements. But of course, how can you go out and look for work if all the businesses are closed and you can't apply for any of the jobs? So we're in really sort of territory that the system isn't designed for. I mean, the other thing that sort of came into place in the 1930s, sort of obviously at the same time that this unemployment system was implemented, were these widespread jobs programs for, for unemployed workers, whether that's the WPA or the CCC or what have you. And there's sort of dozens of these New Deal programs, which employed, millions of people, at least temporarily. And there's a debate about how effective various aspects of the New Deal were in terms of combating unemployment. But we're not seeing, obviously, sort of calls for that now, because I can't figure out a way that would work in the particular circumstances we're facing.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right, but I'd say two things. We're in the very, very beginning of this crisis. I know it feels like it's been dragging on forever, but it's only been less than 2 months really since it's really since we've been locked down, or maybe just about 2 months. And I think so we're sort of in, I don't know, December 1929 in this crisis, or early January 1930. And so to some extent, it remains to be seen what will happen. It also remains to be seen. I mean, President Trump has been saying, as soon as as soon as the lockdowns are over and we start back up, things are going to be great. Now, he's obviously got a reason to say that, but I think that people don't know what's coming next economically. Will we, once there's a vaccine, will things go back to the way they were? Maybe they will, maybe they won't. If they don't, then some kind of relief programs and long-term employment strategies of the kind that were employed during the New Deal will be necessary, I think, and probably will happen.
Yeah.
But it's impossible to tell right now. It's just not possible to predict how that's going to go.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at sort of the bills that have gone through Congress that the president has signed over the past few weeks, on the one hand, they seem just huge amounts of money with very little structure in terms of how it gets allocated and overseen. But on the other hand, one wonders whether it's still not enough for the size of this particular problem.
Yeah, I mean, I suspect it's not enough, but we'll.
Yes, I suspect the same.
And we, the politics of this matters. So currently, the Senate is dominated by Republicans who are less sympathetic to mass government intervention in the economy than Democrats are, as a rule. Now, they do have a vested interest because with the election looming, in trying to do something. So they might be more open to that kind of government intervention than they would be normally. But the political environment is a factor as well. If, for example, we have a Democrat in the White House and Democrats take back control of the Senate, then the kinds of and retain control of the House, then we'll see perhaps very different programs and very different responses to this crisis in a year's time than we're seeing now. If, on the other hand, President Trump retains the White House, then I think we're likely to continue along the path we're on.
All right. And thinking about how unemployment works right now, I mean, one of the things that came up in the 2016 election, which seems like a million years ago now, but it obviously wasn't, is there was an interesting discussion during the 2016 election about the accuracy of the unemployment rate. Because you remember back then, the unemployment rate was below 5%, which, you know, at close to, you know, record low levels. But both Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders said that the rate was an illusion, and which seems very odd that those two guys would agree on much of anything. And that they, you know, argue that there was a, you know, even in good economic times, a sort of a hidden level of unemployment, which I think sort of speaks to how we end up where we are right now. And sort of the job market, especially for people younger than us.
Yeah, I mean, we talked about this a few months ago when we talked about the gig economy. So can you elaborate a little bit, David, on why they were skeptical about that unemployment figure?
Well, okay, so I mean, a couple of things. One is that you know, the way, as we talked about, that sort of unemployment gets calculated is it's people who are of working age who are actively looking for work. And so you sort of count them people who are employed versus the number of people who are not employed but actively looking for work, and that's taken up with a number. And you know, over the years, there have been different ways in which, you know, they've played with that, who gets counted and who doesn't. For instance, Carol Wright, when they originally sort of devised the Bureau of Labor Statistics, they were only looking at men. You know, they didn't consider women to be part of the labor force. And so there's ways in which it's contingent on a variety of ways. But one of the things that I think has really shaped the labor force in recent years, the amount of people who are underemployed, which is to say that they may have employment, but they may have education and training that far exceeds the sort of level of employment they're receiving. So if somebody has a PhD in astrophysics but is working in Starbucks, they're considered employed, even if they're not actually sort of using the totality of their training. Likewise, when we think about the number of people right now who are involved in various kinds of gig employment, whether that's, you know, driving for Uber, for instance, Uber doesn't consider them employees. And so are they unemployed now because no one's taking Ubers because no one's going anywhere or not, right? How do they fit into these systems which are designed for employment in a traditional model where somebody is your employer and they're paying into the system through unemployment taxes? And so I think there's a hidden dimension to the economy in terms of people who are not employed the way they'd like to be. You know, if you are unemployed for a long time and you stop looking for work, then you suddenly stop being unemployed. You know, so if you spend 6 months and you try to find a job and you can't find one, well, I think you and I would consider that person still unemployed. But if they suddenly stop applying for things because they've been tired of being rejected, at least the economist would calculate that person is no longer part of the labor force, which I'm not sure is the full way of thinking about it. So I think that's sort of the you know, the ideas that both Trump and Bernie Sanders were talking about, although they were talking about it in slightly different ways, and doing it for political reasons as much as for analytical reasons. But I think that sort of speaks to some of the problems we're facing right now, where people are becoming unemployed on, you know, a vast scale. But they, even when they were employed, they weren't actually doing all that well, or doing as well as they'd like to be, or doing as well as they felt they should be doing for their training. So we have lots of people who are in huge amounts of student debt that they're still having to pay off, you know, where they were not working the way that they wanted to be, and didn't have sort of prospects for home ownership and all these other kinds of things. So even when the economy on paper looked like it was doing very well, I think for lots of people in the economy, it wasn't as rosy a picture as the top line numbers would suggest.
Well, it's long been observed that Donald Trump thinks the economy and the stock market are synonymous.
Yeah, which they are not.
I mean, we know this, and both are not going in the direction he would like at the moment. But yes, you're absolutely right that in terms of a lot of the – there have been a lot of crises percolating along within the economy before this crisis, and this crisis seems to have exacerbated many of them. That makes me think that depending on what happens politically, and again, not just in the United States, but globally, we may see radical experimentation with in terms of government programs and government intervention in the economy, akin to what we saw in the 1930s. And some of those experiments worked and some of them didn't in response to the current crisis.
And I think we'll also see more labor activism. I mean, I think one of the sort of ironies about these moments of the high unemployment, whether that's in the 1930s or going back into the 1870s, is you would think that labor unions would break under the pressure of high unemployment. But in fact, what you have is a sort of a radicalism that, in labor unions with sit-down strikes and what have you, where labor unions are asserting themselves in a way that they don't in good times. So I think we may see some of that as well. But I think I'm with you that this is not going to resolve itself quickly. I think the idea that things are going to return to normal on any level it's going to take a while. If we ever return to normal, if we have an understanding of what normal is.
I think this has become a cliche, but there will be, it's not unique to me, there will be a new normal. I don't think we're going back to the way things were exactly. In our own sector, and this is something we could deal with in a future episode, I think the university sector is in for revolutionary changes, and in 2 or 3 years things will be very, very different from the way they were even 2 or 3 months ago.
Yes, and I have no idea what that looks like, and I think that's the prospect of millions of people being unemployed, I think is a scary prospect, but I think the sort of uncertainty about how this resolves itself is equally frightening.
Yeah. Well, it turns out that, you know, we're historians. We like to study world historical events and world transformative events.
Yeah, I don't like living through them. I'd rather
living through them is not so fun. So yeah. Much fun, is it?
No, not really.
It is. Well, although one thing I can't claim this, and it was another historian on Twitter. You might have seen this over the past few days. So if you remember the person, please. Okay. Chime in. But somebody made the observation that I think is really interesting, which is we have not, in studying the 1920s and the culture of the 1920s and that kind of cultural efflorescence in literature and jazz and everything else and flappers and, you know, all the things we associate with the 20s, we haven't appreciated the degree to which that might have been a response. Some of that would have been a partial response to the trauma of the flu pandemic of 1918 to 2021, because we haven't appreciated that. But now that we're living through that kind of crisis of that kind of magnitude, that may cause us to rethink how we look at the history of the 1920s. And I'm not a historian of that period, but that's really stayed with me. Did you see that tweet the other day?
I did, and I don't remember who said that, but that is a really good point. I mean, we tend to sort of associate. People have made the linkage between the First World War and the trauma of the First World War and the sort of culture of the 1920s. But the impact of the flu pandemic seems to you know, not been a topic people have done as fully yet, or at least taken as seriously yet. And undoubtedly they now will. I think we're going to get a whole lot of undergraduate dissertations the next few years on the impact of disease on a variety of things.
Yes, well, I've seen in my own field there's been a little bit of a flurry of activity in social media and interest about the yellow fever epidemics in the 1790s and how they might have affected politics in the early United States. And you know, we're always writing about the present when we write about the past, unsurprisingly.
Yes, I 100% agree with that. Right. Well, hopefully the future. Well, hopefully we're wrong about our predictions, but unfortunately, in this case, I think we're actually probably not wrong.
I would love to be wrong. I mean, I would say we don't know. some of the changes that will come out of this crisis will be better. I mean, will be improvements, you know. I don't want to be too rosy and optimistic about it either, because I'm saying this, you know, from the comfortable position of somebody who has a job and a home and at the moment good health. So I don't want to, you know, I'm not suggesting that this is an opportunity not to be missed. But I think we have to be humble enough to recognize that we can anticipate all the changes that are in front of us.
I think that's true. If history teaches us anything, it's that there's things that will come out of left field that are going to be, for both good and bad.
Yes, and I don't know how many listeners have been with us from the beginning, but those who have will know that if this podcast teaches anything, it's that we're terrible prognosticators.
Well, we have expertise in one, temporal domain, and it happens to be the past. At least that's all we claim to have. I'm struggling enough with the present.
Yeah,
and future.
Just...
Future, giving up on that.
Yeah.
All right. Time for last drops. What you got?
Oh, well, speaking of responses to the pandemic, I want to praise public history institutions, and I want to cite one in particular, which is Mount Vernon, the home of George Washington, which is a museum now, and it's obviously you can visit the home in better times, and you should. But Mount Vernon has been putting on some great programming online and available via all your social media platforms. And I'm thinking in particular of Doug Bradburn's performances. Doug Bradburn is the president of the Mount Vernon Ladies Association, the organization that owns and runs Mount Vernon. And Doug is a very fine historian of the early American Republic. And he has done a series of kind of lectures around the house. And he's taking questions live. And Doug is a very engaging lecturer. He's very funny. He's got a very good sense of humor. And so I would urge you to seek out this content. Jim Ambuskey, who's a friend of the pod, is in charge of online content for Mount Vernon. And Jim has been interviewing people, including some people that are well known to us, like Lindsay Chervinsky. The content that Mount Vernon's made available is really, really excellent, and I would commend it to people. And it's a way that – it's showing a way that museums and public history institutions can remain involved and engaged during these very unusual times. So, and Mount Vernon's not the only one, but I think it's one that I happen to look at this week, and I'm very impressed with some of their programming and content.
Yeah, there's been lots of people who've been doing some really great. National Park Service has been doing some great stuff, and
Monticello is as well. Virtual
And I think I saw, and you may have seen this too, that in Monticello they're doing some restoration work that they aren't able to do during normal time because there's always people traipsing through the house. But now there's nobody traipsing through the house, they can actually do some of that work that they had on the back order. So, silver linings for everything, I guess.
Yeah. What about you, David? What's yours?
I want to endorse something that has come up actually a couple times in recent episodes, but I sort of want to bring it to the foreground, and that is the opportunity that some of our listeners may want to participate in. It's the Reddit Ask Me Anything for Historians, Ask Historians, which several of our recent guests have been on or have done. Lindsay did one a few weeks ago. Ben Park did one also a few weeks ago. It's for those of you who aren't Redditors, and I'm not a Redditor, Ask Me Anything is a format where people go on and people who are part of that community ask them questions about their lives and their research or whatever it is, if they're celebrities, about celebrity things. But for this particular subreddit, it's about historians who go on and talk about their expertise and get questions from all over the world. And I did one of these early on during the lockdown because looking for things to do during the lockdown. And I was sort of nervous about it, and it was actually a really great experience. You know, got some questions from people who knew a great deal about the Civil War, some people who were interested in history but didn't know anything at all about the Civil War. And it was fun, you know, and I think that we're all looking for ways to be good historians in this particular moment and trying to figure out how to do it. And so if you are a historian listening to this, You know, there's reasons to be scared of Reddit because parts of it are scary, but at least the Ask Historians subreddit is a great place and a good place to sort of talk about your work if you're looking for a place to do that.
Excellent. Good.
Great. We should get you to do one of these, Frank. It'd be great.
Okay.
No, I'm serious. It'd be great.
All right. Well, I'll look at it first.
First. Okay. Right. I'm going to volunteer you. This is what we're going to do. All right. Until next week, Frank. Cheers.
Cheers, David. Be well.
The Whiskey Rebellion is hosted by David Silkenet and Frank Cogliano. David is a senior lecturer in American history at the University of Edinburgh, and Frank is professor of American history and Dean International for North America at the University of Edinburgh. The Whiskey Rebellion is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and Podbean. You can follow the show on Twitter at Whiskey Rebel Pod and like the show on Facebook for updates about current and future episodes.